Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by FXPhD.com. Take your career to the next level with outstanding up-to-date training, VPN software access to major applications, and direct engagement with industry professionals. Find out more at FXPhD.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. Visual effects has come such a long way from an artistic and tools standpoint in a relatively short amount of time. From time to time, we like to explore and document some of that history. This time, we're going to talk on the software side with Paul Miller. Paul's been involved with many software projects over the years, so if you recognize names like Silhouette, Elastic Reality, Toxic, Spectrum, Tiffin Filters, just to name a few, this is the podcast for you. We'll get to that in just a second. I hope you've checked out some of the recent articles on FX Guide. We've had a bunch of good stuff covering feature films, commercials, music videos, and gaming, as well as tech, and the many shows like the new BFX and CVMP, and we are very close to SIGGRAPH Asia. I also want to mention if you enjoyed the FX Guide TV with character designer Neville Page, we have an uncut 47-minute version of that exclusively available for our FX Insider members. Over at FXPhD, the October 2013 term's in full swing, and we've got so many great courses going on, the forums, VPN access to software, busy as always at both FX Guide and FXPhD. Our guest today on the FX Podcast is responsible for the software Silhouette, which is widely used for roto, paint, and especially for creating complex mats for 3D conversions. As I mentioned earlier, Paul has been involved with a lot of software you likely used or heard of, so let's join Mike Seymour speaking with Paul Miller.
Thanks so much for agreeing to do this. We really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
So you're currently at Silhouette FX, but I wanted to talk, if I could, by using your experience and your history about kind of some of the tools that you've worked on over the years, because it's an amazing story, and I don't think one we've sort of really told here at FX Guide before.
Well, I got into writing software for the visual effects industry back in late 1992. At the time, I was working at a small consulting company in Virginia doing image processing for scanners. And I decided to make a change and get into something with more graphics. And so I moved to Wisconsin, which is where I still am now, and went to work for a company called, at the time, ASDG, which mostly made Amiga software. So I was writing a lot of Amiga software on the side at the time.
And now, I think we should just flag the Amiga, because it's I think it was a really significant piece of hardware in its day. It certainly was, you know, a small kind of PC kind of thing by today's standards, really small. But at the time that it came out, it was sort of the graphics wild child of the industry. It was doing stuff that really set people's alight, because it was sort of seemingly doing stuff at a much lower price point than anything else, and just some really exciting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I bought one of the first Amiga 1000s, I think in 1985, while I was still in high school, and I actually taught myself C so that I could program it. And I was a musician at the time as well, and really into graphics and painting and things like that. So I thought it was the perfect machine to do all that kind of thing, that stuff. And it was a great tool for, of course, learning C and learning how to program graphics.
So did you join when – I mean, did you work on Morph Plus, the original, or Elastic Reality? When did you join?
So I joined I moved up to Wisconsin in December of 92, and they were already working on Morph Plus, and I believe Morph Plus by then had already been used for a couple of episodes of Babylon 5.
Okay.
I may be off a year on that. I came in later than that. But Morph Plus, as you probably know, used the warp kernel that they had developed there at the time. But it used a point-based, like a polygonal interface.
Yep.
While I was there, the owner of the company, Perry Kovalowitz, came up with the idea of adapting that to splines. And so I got in on that project.
Because most people would know the story from Elastic Reality on. I mean, I think Morph Plus is kind of lost in history a little, though Elastic Reality was hugely significant and had a lot of impact in the industry. So while I guess Morph Plus was used in some sort of professional episodic kind of stuff. It had slightly, I remember back in the time, a bit more of a feel of a kind of a trick. And Elastic Reality was the thing that kind of seemed to set the world on fire.
Yeah, it was the innovation of going to Bezier splines instead of that point polygonal based interface that, and of course the addition of the correspondence points, that was a kind of a key innovation as well, and that that's what sort of opened the doors to making morphing really accessible. I believe at the time that we came out with Elastic Reality, there were several tools available on the SGI, but they were all mesh based systems. And within a year or so, we had pretty much crushed them all just from usability.
Yeah, it's funny because back then visual effects were in that era when there was a look or a thing that suddenly came up. Maybe it was at a trade show when it was ever. And it just swept through the industry as like, can you do this? You know, clients would come in, certainly I was working commercials, clients would come in like, I want to do a morph. It was like, it's not like, here's the story I want to tell. What tool should I use? It was like, I want to do a morph. Oh, okay. Well, let's work out a story that we can do one in. And I've got to say, back then as well, not only was it that kind of sense of a single thing happening, but the software was obviously a lot more fragmented than it is, you know, today. It wasn't like everything did everything. They were much more specialist tools. I mean, Elastic Reality was very much a it just captured the zeitgeist.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was kind of fortunate to kind of work on a couple of tools like that. I don't know if you ever heard of a program called No Strings Attached.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the second program that I wrote on the SGI. That was our wire and paint system. We had a scientist on staff that was working on automated wire removal algorithms, and I teamed up with him to write the user interface. And eventually, we figured out that there is no such thing as an automated wire removal algorithm. And so then I focused a lot more on implementing a paint system on top of it with some really good cloning tools. And at the time, Matador, Parallax Matador was the big paint program. But No Strings Attached sort of became a more specialized sort of paint system.
Yeah. NSA was really good. Matador was also really good as a paint system. I was less enthusiastic about Advance, which Matador kind of spun into its larger version of. But again, the other thing I want to mention at this point is in these sort of early period of the 90s, which again is something that maybe is not so familiar to people that are not sort of aware of it looking back from today, a lot of the stuff that was being innovated was happening in television because there was a big difference between like an NTSC or PALRES. HD didn't kind of exist, and then there was like film res, and so you'd see programs like you mentioned Babylon 9, but also Star Trek Deep Space Nine was another great, and the Star Trek before that, Next Generation. A lot of those programs really were really influential in sort of developing these tools.
Oh, absolutely. Perry's, the owner of the company's top clients was Peter Moyer from the Post Group. And they were one of the big drivers of the tools that they were. He was pretty demanding. He wanted tools to do certain things, and then we would implement them. And they did a lot of episodic stuff, and drove really a lot of the features that were in No Strings Attached, for instance. And then VisionArt that was working at Deep Space Nine. So VisionArt was working on Deep Space Nine, and I had the fortune of running into the one of the main guys on that, Ted Fay from VisionArt Santa Monica Studios, at a little small trade show in L.A., and this was probably 1993. And we met, and he was looking for a tool to help him do the 2D to 3D – I'm sorry, the 3D objects to 2D seamless morphing for the character Odo. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Elastic Reality was perfect for that. And he was a great user because he would come back and ask, well, can you add this? Or, I'm clicking this button too many times today. Is there any way that you can cut down on the number of clicks for me? And at the time, I was 23 years old, I guess, and didn't have really much of a social life. And so whatever he asked for, I just did it. And I'd work nights and over the weekend, and then maybe the next day I'd send him another build, and he was able to do some really amazing things because of that kind of collaborative process that we had.
So if somebody was to have gone to NAB around this time in the mid to late 90s, one of the best parties to go to was the Avid party. It was huge. It was amazing. Avid was selling systems like $100,000 and more for offline editing. It was just it was a powerhouse back then. And, of course, in 97, Avid connected up with Elastic Reality, didn't it?
Yeah, they actually ASDG became Elastic Reality, and I think we changed our name in 93, and I think Avid bought – I think it was 1995 that they bought Elastic Reality, and they also bought Parallax on the same day. And so then we all became part of Avid in one day. We didn't know it was coming, you know, as the engineers. And we became part of Avid, and we stayed in Madison for several years until they closed the office down there. But yeah, all of a sudden we were in their huge booth, and I'd been going to NAB since 93, and that just kept going. I pretty much maintained Elastic Reality, and then later on we did some titling software for them.
So where was that appearing in the Avid product line? Was that going into Avid DS? Is that later?
Well, the year they bought Softimage, and then they took pretty much everything from Parallax, the Illusion effects, and some of the processes there, and they also took the Elastic Reality workflow, and they put all that stuff into DS and Softimage. And sort of that became sort of the poster child for all of those things. They never really quite knew how to sell our sort of niche products from Parallax and Elastic Reality. That just never really worked out that well.
Yeah, because there was actually a separate Avid Matador, separate sort of Avid, you know, bunch of products. But yeah, it was almost like that was a bit too much the end game, and they were still kind of, I think, at their heart an offline company.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did make an effort to sort of integrate everything. Do you remember Avid Media Spectrum?
Ooh, you're taxing my memory now.
Okay, so they showed a demo of that. I believe it was in probably 96, 97. No, I'm sorry. It was probably 95, 96. It was right after they bought us. And they wanted to show the effects suite of the future and what they could potentially do with the technologies of Parallax and Elastic Reality that they had just bought. And they sent a couple of guys out, and I believe one of them was Tom Ohanian. That name should probably ring a bell. He was an editor that worked on one of the Bond films before mm-hmm. he became a fellow of Avid. And I think one of the senior the senior workflow guys at Avid, they came out and met with us, and they asked me to write a demo program on the SGI that kind of was essentially a mock-up of an effects tool, and that showed how maybe an effects system of the future might work. And so I wrote this fake system that we worked up some scripts that the artist would do, and he would click buttons, and I actually put a little kind of script system in there so that we could adjust the timing of it. And it really looked like the artist was making it do all these things, but it wasn't. It was all faked. But we were doing things like automated, you know, tracking of shapes, complex shapes, and doing instant color correction and things like that, regional color correction. And they showed this at the trade show along with a couple of other you know, Illusion and things like that. But they kind of showed this as sort of the central workflow environment that, you know, you might be in the future Spectrum product. And this was a complete faked demo. But by the end of the trade show, they were bragging that one of the sales guys was bragging that he'd sold six of these things.
But is that ever really a product?
No, it never really became that product that they envisioned never really became a product. They eventually got us all to build, and this is what became all of our suites. Sort of we tried to make them interoperate as best we could with the Avid system, and we worked on ways of sort of integrating. We made a node for Illusion so that Elastic Reality could plug into it, and they were doing the same thing with Matador. And, you know, they tried to build some kind of semblance of connectivity, but it never really quite panned out.
So now, you and I first started chatting recently, and you dropped a sort of cryptic comment about Stargate, as in not the company, but as in the TV show. So I'm going to have to follow up on that before we move, because I assume that that's happening in that late 90s kind of time frame, or am I out of whack?
No, actually, I was referring to the movie.
Oh, you were. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, the movie, they were working, Kleiser Walczak was working on the original movie. And I you know, at the time, I'm sure you've seen the movie. You haven't done,
absolutely.
I don't think you've done one of your VFX shows about that movie yet. Correct me if I'm wrong, but
we should.
one of my favorite movies. And it so happened, and this was really early on. This was probably in 1990, late 93, 94.
Yeah, because it came out in 94, right?
Okay, yeah, so it must have been early 94, and one of the artists from Kleiser Walczak contacted us, and he says, I'm trying to do these shots, and I'm trying to use Elastic Reality for it, and I just can't make it work. It's not doing what I want. And so we said, well, we're working on version 2 right now. Why don't you send us over some of your footage? And this was a really, really rare time for me to actually see real footage. You know, it's so hard to get working footage and plates, and especially nowadays we get nothing. We have to kind of imagine what problems that we run into. But in this case, they sent over some of the plates, and it was one of the scenes where the characters are fighting, and he's got the helmet on, and they're trying to, you know, morph from the helmet, you know, where the helmet kind of folds up mechanically into amulet. Yeah, so they were trying to actually do that shot in Elastic Reality. And this is before, you know, nowadays you just say, well, we'll just do the whole thing in 3D. But, yeah, you know, sure. Back then, a lot of those things were done in 2D. And they were trying to do it was kind of cool because we were like, wow, he's trying to animate this helmet in Elastic Reality and have all the pieces be cut into little elements and then slide around. And Elastic Reality could, you know, it had pretty good control over depth, but it couldn't really cut things out like that. And it just so happened that at the time I was working on version 2, which had this capability called the cookie cut mat. And you could, you know, enable cookie cut, and it would cut out every single shape separately. And then, you know, because of its natural layering and grouping capabilities, you could actually pull the shot off. So long story short, I was able to give them an early build of version 2 of Elastic Reality, and they were able to hand animate all those shots. They literally went in frame by frame and match moved all of the helmet pieces to the character, you know, action, and they would you know, essentially use the shapes to clone the helmet pieces from the you know, the plate where he's wearing the helmet to the one where he's not wearing the helmet. And of course, they're slightly off, so they had to correct for the different, you know, motion tracks and things like that. It was all by hand, but it was pretty well done. I was ecstatic when we finally saw it in the theater because I know that it was one of the first films I'd kind of managed to help on in some way.
Yeah, that was a Roland Emmerich film, I think. It was before he did Independence Day as well. I think he'd done Universal Soldier, but I think that was kind of it. It was, and at the time, it seemed all breathtakingly clever and wonderful. And that was, like 94 that I would have seen it, I guess. When that film came out. Okay, so you're in Avid. I understand, though, that you obviously didn't stay there for forever. You went off to do other stuff. When did you leave the Avid family?
I left in 1998. At the time, we kind of had put Elastic Reality to bed, and that was my sort of, you know, baby. I'd been working on that for 8 years and six, seven years And I just didn't really like the corporate environment. And, you know, it wasn't them, it was me. And so I decided to leave, and I moved back to Wisconsin, and I joined up with my old boss, Perry Kovalowicz, and we started a company making plugins called Profound Effects, and we made plugins for After Effects and Avid. And
now, I should point out that Perry actually got I don't know if he alone got it, but there was a SciTech Oscar, right, around this time?
Yes, he did. He and Garth Dickey was the engineer that built the warp kernel in Morph Plus and Elastic Reality, and they both received the SciTech awards.
And absolutely, you know, justifiably. So you're doing these other things because there's obviously Perry's going to feature prominently as we move forward on the timeline, but I just can't help but doing a sidetrack. Sometime in here, you were working on Toxic at Discrete, which is obviously Autodesk.
Yeah, that was one that we kind of started this plugin company, and then we started doing consulting projects. And I don't know exactly how we ended up hooking up with Discrete, but we ended up working on a text component for Toxic. And I think that was probably all because of my history doing the Avid Marquee. I was the project lead on that at Avid, and which was a 3D, real-time 3D titling system, which is, I think it's still in use today, but it kind of petered out in terms of its feature set. But it really was, if you ever, you've ever seen it, it was pretty, I'm pretty proud of that project. It was kind of a complete 3D object system, even though you couldn't do a whole lot of modeling with it, but you could do some pretty neat stuff with it as far as a character generator was. So I believe I, you know, my experience on that kind of sort of led us into doing the titler for Toxic, which, as you know, Toxic never really, it never really became what they had intended it to be. And so that, that component never really appeared.
But there are other products that in this kind of what I'm going to call loosely the plug-in area, not least of which is the Tiffin filter stuff, right? Well, it became more than filters, but it started as just filters, right?
Yeah. So the Tiffin stuff came later. Simultaneously with working with Perry with Profound Effects, while I was Avid, one of my little projects that I took upon myself, they didn't really have a plug-in architecture in the Avid system. And so I took it upon myself to design the AVX plug-in architecture. While I was there. And fortunately, when they started rolling out Avid systems with that architecture, I started getting sort of side requests on the side to build plugins for people. And one of my first clients was Peter Moyer and Marco Paolini over at Post Group. And they had these processes that they developed, you know, they working on feature films, and they wanted to encapsulate them into filters that they could use them themselves, but then also sell them to editors. And so they contacted me, and I made the wise choice of becoming a partner instead of taking, you know, hourly payments. And so, right. So that was an early arrangement that I made simultaneously or independently of the Profound Effects thing. And the difference was that Profound Effects made plugins mostly for automating things inside After Effects, and then we did some consulting. Whereas the Digital Film Tools company, which is the one that Peter Moyer and Marco split off from the Post Group, they made filters. They made just complete compositing filters and optical glass simulation filters and things like that. And that business eventually led to we eventually came out with a product called 55 millimeter, which contained simulations of a lot of the Tiffin filter set, and then Tiffin got wind of that and wanted in, and they wanted in on the name, and so that's where that partnership came from.
One of the reasons I mentioned that is that the film stock stuff. The thing about this is, I mean, today on an iPad, and I know that you've done work in that zone, but on an iPhone or an iPad, people apply filters and whack stuff on, and normally it's just if it looks cool, it's valid. But one of the things that impressed me when I first saw the Tiffin stuff back in the day, and then moving into the film stock stuff, you guys were trying at a color science level to get this right. You weren't just mocking stuff up to say, oh, this looks kind of like, a Tiffin filter. You were getting it really accurate because I remember being impressed at the time in our ability to intercut between real filters and digital filters, which was a big deal back then because people were kind of really skeptical that, there would be valid things to do.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear. Marco actually prides himself on how much time he spent on this. He actually went out and rented all these filters and actually shot footage against different backgrounds and really analyzed what they were doing. And then he would break them all down into using Shake. And then once he figured out kind of how he could recreate the look of them in Shake, he passed that on to me. And then I'd implement them in low level C++ and make them fast and then make them work on the various hosts. But we tried to really take an analytical approach. I mean, obviously there's a lot of tricks and nonsense in there. You really can't do some of this stuff optically, but we try to pride ourselves on that. You're saying you can make my biggest pet peeve with the whole mobile photography thing is Instagram. You take a picture of something and then slap this just awful filter on it, and we try to make pictures look better and try to recreate real photographic things. We just recently had an article a review on for our iPad product, Photo Effects Ultra, and from a real photographer, and he was saying the same thing that you are. He says, I normally shoot with like an indie grad, for instance, out in the field, but I don't have to anymore. I can just apply it right on my iPad, and it does the job.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being stunned at the time that Instagram was being sold for $1 billion and Kodak couldn't, stay afloat.
Yeah.
The company that was making stuff look good for decades was giving way to the company that was just trying to make stuff look like crap, but really quickly.
Yeah.
Not that I don't use Instagram myself, but it was kind of ironic.
Yeah, it was definitely ironic for us, and we don't, you know, it's one thing we just don't get the social thing. You know, they got it and they made it work, and that's kind of one of our, you know, at least one of my, I don't know, personal kind of things is I don't get that social aspect of those things, and you know, we're trying to push to professionals and still trying to, you know, spread it, you know, up and down the spectrum of products and as many markets as we can, but you know, it's just one little thing like that we just didn't get that made Instagram what it was, and
a billion dollars later.
Yeah, and $1 billion. Yeah, exactly. I don't know what to do, what I can do to get there.
Because in a very real sense, there's just nothing in that program that, I mean, I'm not trying to dish them, but from a science point of view, from an image processing point of view, there was not an algorithmic innovation that looked like it was worth that sort of telephone number purchase price. But obviously that wasn't what they were paying for. But yeah, it was kind of like, what?
Yeah, I know where you're coming from. You know, exactly, from the technical point of view, it's really all in the social space and less so in the actual algorithms that they're using.
Yeah. So anyway, I wanted to now, of course, get to the product that is possibly one of the greatest, being in the right place at the right time, breakthrough kind of moves. Because many of these products are great, and I certainly enjoyed them. But the one that really just seemed to, in recent times, again, capture the zeitgeist was being around with Silhouette when you were. And I was wondering if you could give us a rundown on that. And also, I kind of owe Perry an apology because I wrote an article a while ago and I didn't give it enough attention. So I want to address that right now.
Okay. It's kind of funny. At the time, I was in a partnership with Perry at Profound Effects, and I was also in a partnership with Peter Moyer and Marco Paolini with Digital Film Tools. And we, of course, knew each other, and we got to talking, and we were like, we're going to make a compositor. and this was, just before, this was 2003, 2004.
Okay.
So we didn't really know anything about, you know, I don't even know if Nuke was out then. It might have been, but, you know, Shake was sort of the big one at the time. Well, then we got to talking more and then realized that, you know, we're a small, kind of a pretty small team, and we're probably not going to pull off a compositor, but, you know, the people are doing a lot of Roto, and it's funny, we learned a lot about Roto from Elastic Reality. You know, we made Elastic Reality as a warping system, but then, you know, by the mid-90s, everybody was using it for Roto. And we were hearing stories all the time for how much people were using it in Roto. So we thought, well, we know we can make a Roto tool and then, you know, add paint on. And so that's what we did. So it was about 2003 I started on it, and we showed it for the first time in 2004 at a SIGGRAPH. And we don't do that anymore. We don't show unfinished software, but at the time it wasn't done yet. And we just wanted people to be aware of us since we were kind of new, and we wanted people to know we had a standalone Roto tool. And we made a kind of a fateful meeting with some guys from Weta at the time that were there, and they were working on King Kong. And they said that they were using, and I don't remember what they were using at the time, but with all the Roto they had to do, it just wasn't cutting it. And they thought Elastic or Silhouette might be the tool they needed. And so in a lot of ways, like the relationship I had with Ted Fay with Elastic Reality back in the 90s, I had a similar relationship with a guy named Jay Bills over down in Weta. We'd talked almost daily, and he would throw ideas at me and about what they would need for, you know, the Roto tools. And I would, you know, implement them, and they'd get daily builds. And eventually that became the tool set that was in Silhouette version 1.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think it was a couple of versions later that it really took off. But there was a couple of things working in your favor. I mean, one of them was when Nuke did come along and very successfully, you know, take up the slack left by Shake walking away from the market. Nuke just didn't have very good Roto tools, and you know, people like me would beat up the Foundry guys who were great guys, but I mean, like, you know, you just don't have good Roto tools. And like, I know this other stuff is fun and clever, and the IP is really cool when you start getting into this other funky stuff over there. But do you guys have any idea how much people spend in Roto? Like, it's the, you know, it's the non-sexy end of the business, but oh my God, it's the, you know, the oil that keeps the entire pipeline running. And they're like,
Yeah, we'd like to think that as well. You know, we know you need Roto. It's one of those things you have to have. And because of what we learned on Elastic Reality, we knew that you need to have a lot of ability to finesse everything. And that's where a lot of our tools in Silhouette are very strong, and we're very strong from the very beginning because we knew people wanted that extra, the extra amount of control. And then, you know, we added paint the following year. And then, of course, we got really lucky the year after that when the big 2D to 3D conversion craze kicked off.
Yeah.
And we were, as you know, you got to roto every single object in every single frame, and it was a perfect tool for that. It one of the things that we pride ourselves on is, you know, we've seen shots that people have done with literally thousands of shapes, and it doesn't crash, it doesn't slow down, it just keeps chugging along.
And even then, I mean, I don't want to take anything away from the visionary work of the team, but it wasn't even a slam dunk that stereo conversion was the way to go, because let's face it, some of the early stereo conversion work was pretty painful. And so it wasn't even as if you could have predicted that, well, of course, the way that all stereo is likely to go, not all of it, but a lot of it, is stereo conversion. Stereo conversion was a line call there for at least about a year or so, I think.
We definitely didn't see it coming. I mean, that's to be fair, we didn't see it coming. But when we started seeing all these requests from various facilities for certain features, then we kind of got it. And version 3 was sort of our big 3D release, where we added the ability to, you know, roto and paint on both eyes simultaneously and shift things around and on left and right and things like that. So, yeah, but. I mean, definitely. That as you said, you know, the early stuff was crap. And
I didn't say that. I was just saying. Okay,
fine. The early stuff was crap. That's from me. But the best 3D conversion that you could probably, you know, admit is the stuff that like Stereo D is doing. Or Framestar or Prime Focus, you know, that where they literally are going the extra mile and doing rotoing everything.
Oh yeah, and quite extraordinarily so, because, you know, I know that there are shots that you've had teams using your product to roto snow, where I'd be like, but hang on, surely that's CG snow? Why doesn't somebody just render it for you? I've been stunned at some of the absolute attention to detail that those stereo teams have done. And again, not particularly sexy in one sense, but oh my God, it is physically painful if they get it wrong. And yeah. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I remember when I saw Titanic again in 3D, and I was just, blown away and how just freaking good it looked. And then I was kind of reminded that, you know, elastic reality was just quite a bit on the first version of Titanic. And then here we are, you know, almost 15 years later with Silhouette being used on the same shots. That elastic reality was. That was pretty cool. But the fact that they could get that level of depth, fidelity, and all from, and we knew, you know, they had 300 guys, you know, just rotoing everything. It was really amazing to me.
In addition to the stereo stuff, I just want to highlight some of the stuff that's in version 5, because there is some really interesting stuff in version 5. And I don't know how much you've been personally involved with these particular things, but I'm sure you can speak to them. I mean, for example, I was really pleased to see that the planar tracker was kind of licensed and integrated in, because that seemed to me to be a really sensible move by your team. You guys seem to play well with others.
Well, we try. That was good. I mean, we tried to write, you know, our own planar tracker, and we did an optical flow based one, and it really, you know, it worked, but you know, obviously it wasn't as good as the competition. So I think Marco kind of brokered that deal to work with them, and, you know, we just do whatever is best for the user, and that definitely improved
because of your ability to export to all the major packages, and not to sort of get up in people's face over it, but just be totally accepting of a pipeline structure, be it Nuke or anyone else for that matter, really was a significant part of the adoption process. It just seemed like that it was built for a pipeline. It was built in the knowledge that in this day and age, you know, if you've got a tool, you need to play well with others.
Yeah, we definitely did focus on the, you know, the ability to export and import things as well. You know, but back when we were working on the first version of Silhouette, people were still using Commotion, so we reverse engineered the file format for that, so we could, you know, bring shapes in from Commotion, and I threw in an Elastic Reality importer as well, because we knew believe it or not, in the early 2000s, people were still using Elastic Reality. I think some guys over at Sony even had a couple of old SGI workstations that were sitting around just to run Elastic Reality on.
Look, I know you guys weren't involved, but I have to say, shout out to the Commotion. I remember Commotion as a terrific piece of software. And again, another one of those early pieces of software that, unlike your stuff, didn't sort of make its way that much further along. But yeah, I mean, Scott Squire's work on Commotion was terrific.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic how it kind of ended up in the same fate as Elastic Reality did. It ended up in Avid's hands and, of course, died away there.
Yeah, I mean, at least the Elastic Realities have kind of moved further along the pipeline inside that Avid world. And ironically, you actually have a morphing node in Silhouette 5, right?
Yes, this is something that Perry had been chomping at the bit
for. Tell me about that meeting. You walk in and sit down, and it's like Perry says, "Hey, I got a good idea. Let's do a morpher, because no one's done that before."
Yeah, well, I knew he kind of wanted to revisit the idea, and he had been thinking about it since selling the company to Avid. He wanted another shot at it, and we let him work on it for a couple years, just kind of tinkering with ideas and things like that, and we ended up with a solution that was much better than Elastic Reality in terms of its curviness. You know, that's the big problem with warping, is making the results look curvy. And
by curviness, do you mean that there's a non-linear translation of the splines, or do you mean as in terms of what are you referring to there?
In the underlying warp, when you start to fold geometry, you don't want it to bunch up in a way that looks polygonal.
Right.
And that was a problem that Elastic Reality had, that if you stretch things and push things and fold things under just right, you'll get popping as the underlying mesh that it builds deforms and things like that from frame to frame. It'll do funky things and won't look quite right. And he was always concerned about having what he called a curvy result, which was more mathematically pure. And so we spent a lot of time, tinkering with that kind of thing. And I think we hit on something that it definitely produces superior results to Elastic Reality. And we did a couple of comparisons with Nuke too. And we think that the results are pretty darn good.
There's one node that is new, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, in version 5, that I was fascinated when I saw it. I've not used it, so I'm ignorant, I guess, but I saw that there was an inverse kinematics roto node. Is that a trend, or is that talk to me about that?
I don't know. It was one of those things that I was just kind of playing around with, and I thought, we have this layering system that uses that where you can set anchor points and things. Yep. And I think I had a user who was trying to model, people walking, and we get a lot of that, and the good roto artists know to break things down into, individual shapes and model things as small as possible. And, I started playing around with the hierarchy system that's in there. And I thought, well, if we have a shoulder pivoting around a certain point, and that's an anchor point. And then if we have like an elbow shape that's connected there, that's another anchor point. And these are all layers, and you can animate the layers and track them, that's normal silhouette stuff. But I thought, well, now that we have this hierarchy already in place, what if we just took a inverse kinematic system? And if you select a couple shapes that happen to be in a hierarchy and start pulling on it, well, why not just have it animate the entire chain of layers for you? You don't have to do them independently, and it worked. So that was sort of an experimental sort of weekend project that made it in. And I don't know. I've never seen it in anything before as far as roto goes.
Yeah, I've never seen it in roto. It just seems like an immensely obvious idea. I mean, I've done something kind of similar in Flame and building my own kind of hierarchical, system with. But to a certain extent, I've not seen anyone do it as I understand how you guys have done it. So it would be interesting to see more of that kind of stuff. I guess the point is whether it's being picked up by your user group and user community and being adopted.
Right. We get a lot of feedback from users. And of course, you have to translate the requests into a working feature. You can't just always just implement the exact thing that the user wants. You have to kind of fit it into the rest of the structure. So a lot of the time is spent, adapting requests and putting it into the system so it's logical and things like that. But sometimes we just come up with ideas that we've never had a request for and just put them in. And there's a lot of stuff in there that's like that. I honestly don't know to what extent that feature is being used, but it's certainly looks good when you're playing around with it.
So you mentioned before that, you know, you've seen people doing thousands and thousands of shapes in Silhouette and it doesn't fall over. But I also understand you got a, I don't know if we can talk about this, but you got a request for somebody to do some 8K work and it didn't fall over there either.
Yeah, that was, people have been doing 8K stuff since IMAX became big. But yeah, the first time I heard somebody doing 8K work was right before Batman, the first of the reboot came out.
Batman Begins,
yes. It was right before that movie came out, and I had a customer saying, my computer's slow, and I asked him what he was working on, and he said, I'm working on 8K. And so first I was kind of surprised, and this was right around the time when 4K was pretty much the max kind of graphics card you could get. And Silhouette will work it with a lower res textures, but it does have to downsample, which is slow. So, but you know, he had an 8K card, and you know, the amount of bandwidth that takes to upload a frame, is high, and he was worried about performance, and so I gave him some tips on how to make it faster, and one of them is just don't roto in output mode, so it doesn't have to render the frame, you know, every time you move a spline, and that's the big one. But yeah, as big as those frames are, and it wasn't really crashing or anything, it just was slow, and so we had to give him some ideas on how to kind of make it less painful.
Though, for a few times in your career, I know you've had those sort of requests and you've got no idea what the film is, nor
exactly
what it is until you kind of discover it later.
Right. I had no idea, what it was. And then within a couple of months, Batman Begins came out. And then I was reading articles about how, several of the shots were done in straight, IMAX and 8K. And of course, in the IMAX theater, you're just amazed when those scenes kick in, and I was blown away. I'm like, oh, it had to have been that movie, now that's more commonplace, but that was, I don't remember what year that was, but that was the first time I realized people were actually doing 8K roto in it.
Yeah. Was that the first film, or was it Dark Knight, the second film? Did they do 8K in the first film?
You're right. It's Dark Knight. It's the one where they had, it was the, with Joker.
Yeah, well, the Joker is the second one, yeah. Because I remember when I was sitting in the IMAX and the first IMAX shots came up, I was just jaw-dropping. It was the bank heist sequence. And,
yes. Yeah, absolutely. My mouth fell open when that first shot came in. And in my head, I pictured people, rotoing and painting on those size of frames and Silhouette. And I was kind of stunned.
It's even more stunning when you think about the fact that somebody sitting at their desk doing that work can't actually look at the whole frame at one time at normal res. You know, it's not like we've got 8K monitors that you can say, oh, let's have a look at that. Hardly the case. So tell me, in terms of customers today and the company, obviously you're still working with some of the companies we've mentioned to date. I mean, obviously Weta used it on Avatar, for example. But you will continue to be used around the world. And Framestore is another one you mentioned?
Yeah, Framestore, Prime Focus, Stereo D, they're doing a lot of the 3D stuff. There's quite a few, in London, where they're all kind of, in that little in part of Soho together. And there's a lot of them there. I'm looking forward to traveling there at some point, just walking down the street and just visiting half of our customer base. There's quite a few in LA. I wish I was more prepared on that.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I'm good friends with the guys at Boundary Visual Effects. And as I understand it, there's a even tighter layer of integration that's happened between Silhouette and Nuke, and there's some really good stuff that.
Yes, absolutely. We know of several facilities that have really. And you were mentioning pipelines before. One of the very first decisions I made in Silhouette was opening up with the Python interface for scripting, and the very first use of it was as a keybind system, so that we knew people like to rebind keys to whatever the heck they wanted. And so I, instead of making a hard coded text file with keybinds, I just made it scriptable. And then we started adding the ability to control it directly with scripts, and we've had quite a few users building really, really nice scripts for doing like tracking and shape manipulation. And we had a guy build us a Nuke importer that with the scripting system. But yeah, we started getting requests. It was a couple of years ago, but they wanted access to the X, you know, they wanted documentation for the XML format that our files are in. And then as we expanded on the scripting, the ability to add things like exporters as Python scripts that they could, you know, easily build these little tools. And yeah, the amount of integration with the pipeline is really impressive. I wish I had more time to, you know, visit them. And
well, I think as one of your business partners once joked, Roto is a bit like Preparation H, right? Yep. Used by everybody and not talked about. But we wanted to draw some attention on it. But I got to ask you, Paul, yourself, what interests you at the moment? Because, I mean, obviously, you've done such an amazing amount of stuff, and this stuff doesn't come out of a vacuum. I always say if you want to know what's coming down the pipe, just look in the research labs today, because it takes, you know, years sometimes for stuff to come to fruition. What's kind of a personal interest to you? Where are you playing around with at the moment?
In the area of software or?
Yeah, okay. Away from your custom beer work.
Yeah, right. Well, I have been doing a lot of research into GPU rendering lately. One of the things that, you know, our at least in terms of our filters, it was at the time pretty fast for what it did. But now that computers are faster and video frames are larger, they're not as fast as they could be anymore. And so I've been doing a lot of research into GPU accelerating a lot of our stuff. And that's been pretty fun and amazing and given me a good chance to sort of look at the architecture for our code, and which some of it's 10 years old, and look at it in ways of sort of re-architecting it and making it cleaner and making use of newer language features in C++ and things like that. So that's kind of where my nerdy technical focus has been lately.
Well, look, it's been great cataloging that evolution of technology. And I must admit, knowing it all and having experienced it firsthand, it's great to have to talk through with you. But also, I've got to say, I hate the idea that some of these things are not well documented, these links that got us from A to B, because there's been a great body of work, but also a great group of people that tend to bump into each other throughout the industry over time. And it's great to see how those patterns move. It's sometimes easier to see them in retrospect than they are to see them as they're evolving.
Yeah, I have to say I've made some really, really great connections and great friendships since the early days from Elastic Reality, and I'm still good friends with Ted Fay. He actually put me in a credit for a movie that he worked on a few years ago and invited me to the premiere sort of as a thank you for my work on Elastic Reality. And of course, you know, that my contact with some of the Guetta guys, you know, they're different companies now, but it, which is great. They move to another company and then say, oh, you got to get Silhouette. And that's probably the best thing.
Yes. Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for taking time. And, hopefully Perry will get me off the hook for rudely skipping him over, a couple of years ago when I wrote that article, but, yeah, pass on my thanks to the guys.
Okay, well, thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor to talk to you.
Well, thanks to Mike and Paul, and certainly a lot of software that I've crossed paths with over the years. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. And the RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produce the High Definition Video Podcast, as I mentioned earlier in the show, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And also, as I mentioned, we have a sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. So that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.